When you're walking around, maybe in a park, the forest, or even the city, do you ever tune into the song of birds? Like, really tune in?
So you got some birds out there that, you know, produce one learned simple song, like a just like mm-hmm. that, right? And that's my song sparrow whistle. Then you have some other birds that can go. So they can produce lots of different varieties of song. They're both vocal learners, but one's more advanced than the other.
What can bird whistles teach us about the ability to learn language? Why can some birds talk?
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
But dogs can't. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is a podcast extra from The Pulse, an exploration of language across species, different bird dialects, and even dance. The whistles you just heard are from Eric Jarvis. He is a neurobiologist, a professor at the Rockefeller University, and investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute.
I'm most interested in how the brain controls spoken language.
And Eric looks at that in different species. I mean, we think of humans as the only species, so to speak, that has language. But what other animals have language?
Yeah. So to define what other animals have language, we really have to define what are the components of language.
Mm-hmm.
And we humans don't realize that there are multiple components that go into what we're doing right now, talking. Some of them are common throughout the animal kingdom, and some are rare. The common one is the ability to form new memories of sounds you hear and understand the meaning of those sounds, like a dog learning how to sit, hearing the human word sit. What's rare is the ability to produce that sound sit, to actually say it or even say whole sentences. And so only the species that have this vocal learning ability can do that.
Mm-hmm. So which species can do both?
It's us humans, the whales and dolphins, bats, elephants, five groups of mammals, and three groups of birds, that's songbirds, parrots, and hummingbirds, have the ability to produce the imitated sounds that one might call spoken language.
So they can hear sounds and then reproduce that sound.
That's right. And not only do they hear and reproduce, they can recombine them into new orders.
Eric says that one reason why humans and other creatures have evolved to having language is that we select for it. And a lot of species find talking kind of sexy.
All vocal learners produce learned sounds for mate attraction, but only some of them, like humans and parrots, will use it for other means. And so one idea is that in all of these vocal learning species, the male or the female that produced the most elaborate repertoire sounded the most intelligent, therefore the most sexy, and is selected for. And then that selection keeps that trait going and gets more and more advanced, and then eventually used for something else like we have for spoken language.
And what do you want to learn more about when it comes to this language, whether it's in birds or in humans or in other species?
Well, the first thing I want to learn is how is it happening? What's the mechanism in the brain that allows us to hear sounds, repeat them, and then form these long combinations of words? The second thing I'd like to know is how did it come about in a similar way between us humans and these other non-human animals that can learn how to imitate sounds? Even though there are differences between humans and these other species, and even amongst the other species, there's a lot of similarities in how they learn how to imitate sounds. We found similarities in the brain circuits, and we found similarities in the regulation of genes in those brain circuits between humans and these other species.
So give me an example of that. Maybe we'll start with the how is it happening. How do we do this? Like, if I'm a baby and I hear this language, and then eventually, without anybody telling me, like, here's how you do this, I learn how to also talk.
Yeah, so the how, as far as we know now, is that in the auditory pathway that all these species have, we first form this auditory memory of the sounds we hear. So the baby hears mama, for example. Mm-hmm. And the baby can even understand those words before the baby can speak it. That's the auditory pathway, the perceptual pathway.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then that information has to be transferred to the motor pathway that controls the voice. All right. Such that it tells the motor pathway how to pronounce the sounds, and the baby starts to babble and starts to then try to imitate the sounds after that and doesn't quite get it right. Goes ma, ma, you know. And through practice, okay, hears itself and it said, oh, I got it wrong. Let me do it again. Got it wrong. Let me do it again. Again, over and over to try to get the sound. And one day goes mama, right? And so this sensory motor feedback, as we call it, the sensory is the hearing and the motor is moving the muscles of the mouth and the tongue and the larynx. This sensory motor feedback is a loop in the brain that is the mechanism of how we do it.
And then it continues to grow. Like, I remember my pediatrician at some point when my daughter was, I forget how old, maybe 5 months, she said, oh, she should start forming the G sound. And I thought, really? Like, it's that precise? And then sure enough, a week later, she started going like, you know. So it's amazing how that progresses.
Yes. And apparently some sounds are harder to learn how to produce than others, so they tend to come later. But yes, it is amazing. To follow up on that, what is going on there that's different in the vocal learning species compared to the others is that all these other species do have the ability to perceive these sounds close to the way we do it, but not, of course, not the same. But they hear the sounds. They process it in their brain. But they don't have the circuit that produces the sounds or produces learned versions of those sounds. They can produce innate sounds from the brainstem regions, but up in the cortex, the forebrain, we humans, that baby, the songbirds, the parrots, have these specialized forebrain circuits that control the production of the new learned sounds.
This is what separates dogs from people from a language evolution perspective. Dogs are only able to produce their innate sounds, the barking, the whining. They don't learn barking by hearing other dogs bark and then suddenly barking in a new or different way.
What they do learn how to do with those innate sounds is learn to when to bark, what to bark for.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Bark for food, bark for attention, bark to go outside. You know, maybe even try to bark 4 times to go outside, 2 times for food. You can even teach dogs to do that. So we call that vocal usage learning, learning when to make a sound, whether it's innate or learned, as opposed to learning how to modify a sound, which would be vocal production learning.
Birds, like us, learn by listening to other birds' sounds and trying to replicate them, learning a whole variety of songs in their youth, with some variation even between species and regions. And do they take songs and patterns from other birds, or does it stay within the species?
Most species imitate sounds of their own species, and they're culturally mm-hmm. transmitting repertoires like we do for language through their own species, generation after generation. And you can get dialects in different geographic regions like you get different languages. But there's some species, like a mockingbird or an African gray parrot, that steal sounds from other species or steal it from the environment, even car horns and so forth.
What do we know about birds that imitate human speech? Why do they do that? Do they also imitate other birds and so on?
The general term we use for these species, including humans, are mimics.
Mm-hmm.
So these mimics that imitate other species also are the ones that can imitate human speech, like a lot of the parrots. Starlings can do this. Crows can do this as well. Many people don't realize crows are songbirds.
Oh, so crows could talk?
Yeah, there have been cases where folks have gotten crows to learn some human speech words.
How are you? How are you?
Is that really hard for birds? Because, I mean, they don't have the same apparatus as we do, right?
That's right. They actually have something called the syrinx. It's a different organ than the larynx, but it evolved in a convergent way. And some muscles in the vocal tract that they use. And there are limitations on the kind of sounds that the syrinx can produce. just like their limitations on the kind of sounds we humans with a larynx can produce. So no matter how good a vocal learning species we are, there's some sounds we're not going to produce because we just don't have the right muscles for it.
And what's hard for birds? Like, if I think about a parrot talking, I'm thinking a parrot going like, "Laura, Laura," or something like that. But I don't think of a parrot saying, "Hello, dear, how are you?" That type of thing.
Oh, but you can get a parrot to say, "Hello, dear, how are you," though.
Really?
Yes. Oh, yes. One of my favorite parrots is Disco. You can go online and do some search and you'll find him. BBC also recorded him.
It's not easy, Baybrain. I am not a crook. My name is Disco.
A lot of times you don't understand the sentence structure, but Disco did produce combinations of words in appropriate context, which indicates that they know something about what they're doing.
Now, you mentioned something earlier about birds having specific patterns or something akin to dialects. Like, is that a regional thing? Like, does a bird from New York sound different from a bird that lives in Kentucky?
Yes. Yeah.
How so?
So whenever you have cultural transmission of information, as opposed to genetic transmission, cultural transmission is more flexible. Things can change. And so vocal learning is cultural, just like spoken language. So that if you are separated by a geographic barrier for many generations, like what happened to humans, like this then leads to English, French, Spanish, or Chinese, and so forth, and Native American languages, over time, the repertoire changes, just naturally changes in the population. And this is exactly what happens with songbirds and parrots and hummingbirds as well. A northern mockingbird and a southern mockingbird will have different repertoires, or east versus west coast.
And would you be able to hear that? Would you be able to go, "Oh yeah, that must be a west coast"?
Yeah, actually, what surprised me was actually listening to some hummingbirds. I was doing a project in Brazil a number of years ago on hummingbird vocal learning. And at that time, not much was known about hummingbird vocal learning. Still not much is known, but it was less than it is now. And we were trying to demonstrate if a particular species is really a vocal learner, we should be able to go to different parts of Brazil at that time and hear different songs from the population. And this is exactly what happened. But the song that we heard, this particular, called a Fanta Croa, a hummingbird, sang, I can instantly tell it was a species, but it was a totally different song, like 200 miles south from where we were in a place called Santa Teresa.
Huh. Do you remember what it sounded like?
Oh, my goodness. It's hard for me to imitate a hummingbird because it's so high-pitched. But it's like, no, that's too, it's really... Yeah,
like something,
there you go. Yeah. That's how one sounded, right? So that was the rhythm of one. And the other way was like in another location.
Before Eric Jarvis became a biologist traveling the world to listen to birds, he was a dancer. You come to the field of biology, I guess, by way of dance. How did that happen?
Yes, I was training to become a dancer when I was in the High School of Performing Arts in New York City. But towards my senior year in high school, I had fallen in love with science by that time as well. And I was trying to make a decision, do I become a scientist or a dancer? And I had good opportunities for professional dance, but I listened to something in my head that my mother always said, do something that has a positive impact on society. And I felt I can do that better as a scientist than as a dancer.
And does dance still come into your work now?
Oh, yes. I dance every week. Even during the pandemic, I have a little dance studio at my home, my apartment. Your question more specifically was, has it entered my work as opposed to do I still dance? And the answer is yes, it has. What happened is back in 2009, there were some discoveries that only species that learn how to imitate sounds like we do for spoken language are the ones that can learn how to dance, can synchronize their body movements to a rhythmic beat of music. And so it turned out there is some relationship from the ability to imitate sounds to ability to synchronize your body to sounds.
That sounds so surprising and amazing. So only species that can imitate sounds can learn how to, quote, dance. And I guess we're applying the term dance lightly here.
That's right, yeah. So only species that can learn how to imitate sounds are the ones that can learn how to dance. And what I mean by that is synchronize their body movements to rhythmic sounds of music.
How did that discovery come about, that those things were linked?
And so there was this parrot called Snowball, it's a cockatiel, that grew up with some young teenagers. And these teenagers liked to dance to the Backstreet Boys. And this parrot was watching them and observing them and actually copying them. And so, you know, they put it on YouTube and Snowball became famous. And some scientists who knew about this dogma that dancing to the rhythmic beat of music was unique to humans saw this parrot and got surprised. Wait a minute, this is not supposed to happen. So they went to the owners of Snowball and basically tested out, can they get Snowball to move to the rhythm of the beat? If they increase the beat timing or decrease it, and Snowball would follow the beat. So then somebody else went out and then tested other species, like elephants, who are vocal learners, and other birds and so forth. And they found that only the vocal learning species can do this.
And what do we think could be the relationship there?
I think it is that what we're doing right now, spoken language, requires a rapid integration of sounds that you hear and sounds that you produce. And the sounds you produce, you're using the muscles of your larynx and your tongue and your jaw. And so you need this rapid auditory hearing integration of movement output for the larynx. And somehow that mechanism contaminated the rest of the brain. And so now sounds you hear are influencing other muscle groups.
What do you hope to learn about this connection between language learning and dance? That's so interesting. Where do you think that could go?
So I like to know, in us humans and these other vocal learners, are there specialized connections that take sound from the ears and integrate them into the brain circuits that control the muscles of the body? And if those specialized connections and genes that control those connections, are they the same ones that gave rise to the spoken language circuit? And if that is true, it would suggest that the mechanism of learning how to dance came from language. And what's interesting about that is that some cultures, they don't distinguish a difference between dance and music. They're the same thing.
With everything that Eric is learning about different species and their abilities, especially when it comes to language, it makes humans feel a little bit less special, I guess. Does this suggest anything new in terms of how we sort things and how we think about the, I don't even want to say tree of life, but I think, yeah. I mean, you know, how we organize things into these different patterns and have thought about evolution?
Yeah, I think we humans overrate ourselves and tend to underrate some other animals. And so even though Darwin didn't present it that way, as evolution as linear, a lot of early evolutionary scientists, you know, interpreted it that way, that evolution had a purpose, and the purpose was to generate humans, and the closer you are to humans, the more advanced you are. This is not true, right? Mm-hmm. Evolution is messy. Evolution is stochastic, and you can get advanced behaviors of all types, for visions, for vocalizations, for sound, you know, hearing things and so forth, in different groups of animals, and it doesn't have to be the one that's closely related to you. Because of this, we should stop using terms like lower and higher mammals or lower and higher vertebrates. We should stop things using terms like neocortex, like that's the new cortex. A bird doesn't have the kind of neocortex we have, but it's still it's pretty advanced.
Eric Jarvis is a neurobiologist. He is a professor at the Rockefeller University and an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He's also the co-leader of the Vertebrate Genomes Project. This was a special podcast extra from The Pulse. Our engineer is Charlie Kyer. Our producer is Lindsay Lazarski. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Subscribe to The Pulse and get a new episode each week. You can find our website at whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott.